The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth, and I'm back with IJ Senior Vice President and Litigation Director Dana Berliner and IJ Senior Attorney Bob McNamara. The discussion today is a continuation of our foray into law for non-lawyers. Previously, we talked about standards of review. Now we're going to discuss some of the most important and most common constitutional provisions involved in IJ's litigation. Today's topic, due process and equal protection. Dana, the concepts of due process and equal protection under law are probably concepts that are familiar to most of our listeners, but where did they actually come from in the law?
Well, the idea of due process, the ideas of due process and equal protection really are inherent in the idea of law, because law is a system of rules governing the interactions between other people. And the whole idea of them is that they will be regular, that they will apply in the same way to everyone, and that there will be a predictability to them. That's the whole idea of having legal rules. I think that they started, probably were first found in Magna Carta, although it could have even been earlier. Certainly they've been around in the English common law for, you know, hundreds of years. And then, of course, they're in the United States Constitution, in the Fifth Amendment, and eventually then were put into the 14th Amendment.
And adding them, is that something that the founders had to talk about? Or because they were so, you know, enshrined in the common law and in the English law, was just something that they, why bother to write it down, I guess, is that?
Well, I mean, certainly I don't think those would have been the controversial concepts when talking about the Constitution. There was a lot more argument about what the structure of the executive branch would be and what the judiciary would be and how many, you know, branches of the legislature and all of that sort of thing. But whether we would have a Bill of Rights was a big dispute at the time of the founding. Some people thought, ultimately justified, that if there was a Bill of Rights, that the courts and others would believe that there were no other rights besides those that were enumerated. And so there was a big argument about whether to enumerate rights or not. That's turned out to be a huge issue in our jurisprudence, and certainly a huge issue for IJ, because we're typically litigating about rights that have not been enumerated. But due process and equal protection, I think, were really always, I don't think that those were questioned as a thing that would be in there if there was going to be a discussion of rights.
But it's not something that we can take for granted, right? I mean, the way that they've evolved, even in sort of modern law, is that something that has changed, or the way that they're interpreted has changed from the time of the founding or earlier?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's fair to say there was no real controversy about the idea of due process of law, except that everyone understood it differently and assumed that everyone understood it the same way. And I think it's fair to say that the concept of due process of law was well established, and what wasn't well established and kind of continues to be what we fight about today are the boundaries of that concept. And so people hear about due process, and due process is about the process the government has to give you. You have to be entitled to a hearing in a criminal trial. You have to have a jury. Things like that are the process the government has to go through before it can deprive you of your rights. But what the Constitution actually guarantees is not just due process, but due process of law. And that means that there are certain things that the government can try to do that, no matter how much procedure it's dressed up with, is nonetheless in conflict with the law, with this fundamental idea of law or law of the land. And in early cases, the examples you see courts reach for are a law that simply does nothing more than takes from A to give to B. That would be an act of will. That wouldn't be an act of law. And that would be illegitimate, essentially, no matter who did it, no matter how much process it was dressed up with, no matter how many votes it got in the legislature. If the law just says we are taking $100 from Dana to give that $100 to Melanie, that's contrary to the fundamental law of the land. That's just not a lawful act when done by government. And really, a lot of what we've been fighting about ever since then, and what a lot of IJ cases come down to, is what falls into that bucket of just taking from A and giving to B and being illegitimate, and what falls outside of that bucket such that the government can do that to you.
And there's actually two courts talk about procedural due process, which is the process that is applied and whether it is fair, and substantive due process, which is what Bob is talking about. Is this something that government can do at all? And today we're basically going to be talking about substantive due process, and we'll tell you all about procedural due process another day.
Another day. Is the substantive stuff the most interesting? Is that where IJ tends to operate, or do we actually do both? And
I love all my children equally. I wouldn't say anything's more interesting than anything else. But I will. So I try to actually avoid the term substantive due process. Some people like to make fun of the idea of substantive due process because substance is different from process. And so saying something is substantive due process is like calling it a pastel green redness. It's just a phrase that doesn't make any sense. And what they overlook is that the phrase substantive due process was coined by progressive activists at the beginning of the 20th century who were opposed to courts using due process like this. So it's a stupid name because it was coined as a rhetorical move by the doctrine's enemies. And so I have no truck with that name. But what I do have truck with is the basic idea that the legislature can't just vote to take from A and give to B, that that violates certain notions of fundamental due process of law, just notions of what the law of the land is, in the same way that the fundamental law of the land is that when we convene a criminal trial, the jury is supposed to be voting on whether the defendant is personally guilty, not whether the defendant's cousin is personally guilty. And you can dress it up with all the process you want, and you can, you know, let the defendant call as many witnesses as he wants. But if the question is whether the defendant's cousin is guilty and he's going to be punished for the sins of his cousin, there's no amount of procedural regularity that's going to make that okay. That violates just sort of fundamental legal precepts that are the foundational assumptions the Constitution's built on in the first place.
So you mentioned there was a little bit of controversy as this has been developed over the, you know, the past 100 years or more, maybe. Are there some cases or historical moments that were especially important or that really stand out in terms of getting us where we are today?
So really where a lot of the fight is today, at least as IJ cases are concerned, is how you go about figuring out whether a law is a law that just takes from A and gives to B, or whether a law is a valid exercise of the government's police power to protect the general public health and safety. And really, the question of how you investigate that is what we've been fighting about for, you know, the bulk of the 20th century and the entirety of the 21st century. That in the middle of the 20th century, around the time of the New Deal, the U.S. Supreme Court became very reticent to conduct that investigation at all. And it articulated what came to be known as the rational basis test, which says that as long as the government's activity could rationally be thought to advance some legitimate end of government, we're going to end the inquiry there. And that test is really what we're fighting about in a lot of the IJ cases that have to do with substantive due process. As, for example, we several years ago challenged a law in Louisiana that made it illegal to arrange flowers without a license, literally roses, baby's breath, crime. And our argument was that that's a law that takes from A and gives to B. There's no public health or safety justification for licensing florists. Louisiana is the only state in the country that licenses florists. And so that's just taking away from people who want to be florists in order to enrich existing licensed Louisiana florists. That's taking from A and giving to B. That's what the courts have said you can't do since time immemorial. And the first time we filed the lawsuit, we actually lost in the trial court because the trial judge said, well, wait a minute. The real question here is whether a rational person could imagine this was advancing some legitimate end. And I can imagine that licensing existing Louisiana florists is a way to protect the public from the dangers of infected dirt. And therefore, this isn't just an A to B transfer. This is about the important public goal of protecting people from infected dirt. And fundamentally, I think the question we fight about in IJ cases is whether the courts should care whether the dangers of infected dirt are imaginary, as in fact they are, or whether the mere fact that the judge can imagine them is enough. So nobody's really disputing this core idea, this idea that there's a fundamental rule of law that says you can't just take from A and give to B. What we're really fighting about is how seriously we're going to look to see if the government is violating that precept.
And so last time we talked about standards of review and how there are these different levels of whether courts care or not. In economic liberty, which is supposedly an unenumerated right, meaning the Bill of Rights mentions due process, but it doesn't actually say the right to engage in the common occupations of life. So that's typically treated as less important, something courts care less about. And then our litigation of due process, which we do in essentially all of our economic liberty cases, comes down to this question of how seriously the court will take the right to due process and how much they will care whether what's happening is outside of what should be happening in law at all.
So that makes the connection between then due process and the standards of review and the rational basis test. What about equal protection? Because those are concepts that are often talked about hand in hand. How do they fit together?
So equal protection had a slightly different history, obviously, at the time of the founding, despite the general belief in equal protection of laws. We had slavery. We had no legal protections for women. It was equal protection for some people, but not for other people. And that gradually has become, obviously after the Civil War, and now there actually is supposed to be equal protection of the laws. The rational basis test applies to both equal protection and due process, unless you're talking about race or about gender or a couple other things. But the analysis is slightly different. When you're talking about due process, you are explicitly saying, is this just so far outside what the government can appropriately do that it violates due process? If you're talking about equal protection, you're comparing the way a particular person or group of people are treated with other people that are supposedly in the same position. So instead of saying, is it insane to license florists for putting together roses and baby's breath, you would say, does it make sense to treat people who have taken a test about floral arrangements administered by other people who already have a license, does it make sense to treat them differently from normal people who actually combine roses and baby's breath all the time? So it's a comparative analysis in a way that due process is not. And in most of our economic liberty cases, we do both, but not always. Sometimes one makes more sense than the other. So, for example, in our certificate of need case in Iowa, the most important question really is, does it make sense to treat two groups of doctors differently, both of whom want to be able to have medical equipment? Does that make sense? That's more of an equal protection case than a due process case. I think, on the other hand, probably the florist cases were more due process. Certainly the braiding cases usually are more about due process, where we're saying, like, look, you don't even learn braiding in cosmetology school. These people already know how to braid. They should be able to braid.
But there's a certain sense in which the two arguments are, in most cases, sort of two sides of the same coin, because you could say, you know, I want to braid hair, and I am, with respect to braiding hair, I'm similarly situated to someone who's a licensed cosmetologist, because being a licensed cosmetologist Bless you.
Bless you.
Live to tape. Being a licensed cosmetologist doesn't teach you anything about braiding. It doesn't test anything about braiding. And so as far as the state's concerned, I'm just as good a braider as someone who has a cosmetology license, because the cosmetology license doesn't create a meaningful distinction between us. And that's the equal protection argument. But you could just as easily say, and we do say in these cases, look, the state says it's worried about protecting the public health and safety, but we can tell they're not very sincere about that because they let these people who have no training in braiding, who have not been tested on braiding, who know nothing about braiding, do all the braiding they want. And if they were really worried about public safety, then they wouldn't let these people who don't have any public safety training do the thing that they say is dangerous. And so it's the same set of facts. It's just a matter of how you frame the argument that you could say that making these arbitrary distinctions among people violates the Equal Protection Clause, and it does. But it's also true that making these arbitrary distinctions among people also makes it less likely the government's really serious in saying that it poses some threat to the public to let people arrange flowers lest they unleash infected dirt on an unsuspecting populace.
And we tend to make both arguments because you never know which one the court will go for.
That's what I was going to ask next is does one of these tend to work more often or with different types of judges, or there's not really a rhyme or reason to.
It doesn't feel like it. It feels like, because we've had cases where the court has said, no, this is only a due process claim. I'm ruling against you on equal protection, but for you on due process. Makes no sense why that would have been the case. And we've had it go the other way as well. We make both because you just never quite know what is going to fly. With equal protection, sometimes the problem. So the usual argument is that you're treating things that are the same differently, and that violates equal protection because two groups of people are similarly situated. They're being treated differently for no reason. But there's a flip side of that, which is recognized by some courts but not others, where you're treating two things that are different the same. And
what's an example of that? Maybe in an IJ case or another case?
Well, let's see. I guess two things that are different. That's come up.
So that's an argument we made explicitly in our braiding cases, which is that the state was treating hair braiders as if they were cosmetologists, and they weren't. They didn't do any of the things that you learned in cosmetology school. They didn't use any of the chemicals that were the basis for justifying regulating cosmetologists in the first place. They didn't even cut hair. They didn't use sharp implements. And so treating them like they were cosmetologists violated the Equal Protection Clause in the same way that it violated the Equal Protection Clause to allow licensed cosmetologists to braid, but not allow people who actually knew about braiding to braid, because the distinction had nothing to do with any actual public health or safety concern.
But so like the Ninth Circuit does not recognize this type of equal protection claim, but some circuits do. And the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated that it exists, but, you know, that doesn't always mean the lower courts care about that.
So sometimes we have all three things, both sides of that equal protection plus the due process, and you just kind of float them out there and see
which one
the court is amenable to. Mm-hmm. So one of my personal favorite cases where I think that these arguments have come up is the one here in D.C. on behalf of daycare providers. Could you kind of talk through that example just to kind of tie it all together for people, how the due process, the equal protection plays out for the D.C.?
Sure. So D.C. adopted new regulations that require anyone who's a lead teacher in a daycare anywhere in the district to have a specialized college degree in child care. And this raises exactly the constitutional issues we've been talking about, because there's no formal degree program that D.C. wants you to have. What D.C. wants is for you to get a degree that has a certain word on the front of it. And there are no regulatory requirements for what you have to be taught in the course of obtaining that degree, how many credit hours it has to take you to obtain that degree. And so we have actually one of our clients has a master's degree. She works in a daycare. She's worked in a daycare for years. She's worked as a therapist. She's eminently qualified, but she doesn't have a bachelor's degree that has the right words on it. And so under the terms of the regulations, she actually would be required to go back to college because she has too much education. She has too much education to be qualified to be a lead teacher. And so the argument is, look, she is similarly situated to someone who has this degree for two reasons. One, as far as the evidence is concerned, she's just as qualified. But two, because you haven't given any content to the degree, it's literally meaningless to say that what she needs is a degree program, is a degree from a program that uses a certain phrase to characterize the bachelor's degree they would give her. Because there's a wide variety in early childhood education programs. Some programs require a certain number of credit hours in early childhood education. All of them, to get the degree, as any degree program requires, require you to take electives, and they differ in the number of electives and the variety of electives. And in some instances, what it literally means is that the reason somebody can't be a qualified lead teacher in a DC daycare is that they haven't taken a college-level English essay class. And writing college-level English language essays has nothing to do with caring for children under the age of three. You know, that may well be a worthy pursuit. That could be a great class to take, but it doesn't make you any better at caring for a two-year-old. And so the argument isn't that DC has no right to regulate the provision of daycare. Obviously, DC can regulate the provision of daycare. The argument is that this is not the way you would do it if you were especially serious about improving outcomes or protecting the public health and safety, because it is arbitrary. It's the essence of arbitrariness. It doesn't require any particular training in any particular thing. It just requires a piece of paper that has a magic word on it. And if you don't have that magic word, there's no amount of actual education that will qualify you. And that is both arbitrary. It violates the due process of law because it's an A to B transfer, and it's an equal protection violation because you're treating me differently than that person, even though I may have an education that's just as good that doesn't have the magic words on the piece of paper. And if you're going to require education, the argument goes, you have to require education in something instead of education that is called something.
So most of the cases that we've talked about have been cases that deal with the right to earn a living, you know, for the florists, the hair braiders, the daycare providers. Do these arguments come up in other kinds of IJ cases, or really is it mostly in the economic liberty context?
It's mostly in economic liberty, but we also do have due process arguments and sometimes equal protection arguments that come up in property rights. And so, for example, Bob's working on a property case now that has some significant due process claims that you alluded to before about the punishing people for the acts of their cousin. So you can tell
right.
us about
that. So we have a case right now in Granite City, Illinois, and Granite City has what it likes to call a crime-free housing ordinance, which means that under the crime-free housing ordinance, if any member of your household or any guest in your household commits a crime in Granite City, or in some cases anywhere on the planet, Granite City orders your landlord to evict you. If you rent your property, your landlord is required as a matter of law to evict you. Even if the landlord doesn't want to, even if you're a good tenant and are up to date on the rent and the landlord wants to keep you there. And Granite City's actual justification for this is that by having a guest who committed a crime, even if they committed the crime after they left your house, you have failed to exercise your duty to control your guests. But of course, you have no power to control your guests. They're adult human beings who have left your house and are out there in the world. And it raises one of these kind of fundamental due process of law questions, which is, can the government impose a duty on you that you have literally no power to comply with? And it's something that the courts have never really had to grapple with because it's something nobody's ever tried to do. In the same sense that nobody's ever tried to have a criminal trial about whether your cousin committed a crime, because one of the fundamental notions of law is that we punish people for things they did, not for things that people who happened to be near them at some point did. And it raises sort of fundamental issues of what due process of law means. In a sense, it doesn't matter how many hearings you hold, how many witnesses you hear from, if the question you're asking is, well, after Melanie left Dana's house, did she commit a crime the next day?
Probably.
Probably, almost certainly. But you know, answering that question doesn't tell us anything about whether we're allowed to punish Dana, because at common law and in sort of the basic fundamental precepts of this country, you can't punish someone for another person's crime, and you can't punish someone for failing to prevent something that they had no legal power to prevent. And sort of the question in the case is there a fundamental constitutional entitlement to essentially not be punished for a crime of which everyone agrees you are innocent. And it's something that, as with many IJ cases, it's something that no one has ever really squarely had to adjudicate, mostly because no one's ever really tried this before. Sometimes kind of our opponents will criticize us for trying to push judicial review to new places. And that's really not what we're doing. I'm perfectly content for judicial review to stay right where it is. The people pushing things to new places are legislatures who keep inventing new ways to trample on people's rights. And when the legislature gets creative, the question has to become, like, at what point do they cross the pre-existing boundaries? And just because no one's ever crossed that boundary before isn't evidence that that boundary doesn't exist.
I mean, you had actually, when we were talking earlier today, you mentioned a case that is it the Supreme Court is going to consider about a law out of Kansas that has to do with a pretty substantial change to the way that people are protected.
No, I mean, there's a case in front of the Supreme Court right now where the state of Kansas has abolished the insanity defense, which just nobody's ever tried before. And it raises this genuinely important question of, like, when we talk about what it means to be guilty of a crime, does that include the idea that someone's not guilty of the crime if they were insane at the time the crime was committed? And, you know, there are arguments that that is just inherent in the concept of due process of law. There are arguments on the other side, but it's one of these issues that just genuinely has never come up because it never occurred to any government agency to say, well, you may well have been insane at the time you committed that crime, but we just don't care. We're going to barrel ahead anyway. And a lot of the envelope pushing you see in areas surrounding due process are areas exactly like this, where I don't think anyone could fairly say this is the U.S. Supreme Court marching into this area that is the inherent province of the states. This is also the state marching into this area that was inherently the province of due process. And somebody's going to have to draw the line of exactly where the boundaries fall. And that one is not an IJ issue and an IJ case, but it illustrates exactly kind of where these fights are happening, which is, you know, modern governments decide to get creative with how they're going to treat people's individual rights, with how they're going to treat the criminal justice system, with how they're going to treat basic ideas of how we punish crime, including whether we punish criminals or whether, you know, we decide to punish people who know criminals. And as they adopt these creative new programs, it's going to require the judiciary to decide exactly what the outlines of the due process of law are. And those outlines, I think everyone or nearly everyone agrees exist, and in many instances just have never been tested.
One thing I think, though, that is interesting, I don't quite agree that I'm satisfied with where judicial review stands at the moment, mostly because of how federal courts particularly often treat rational basis. But the fact that municipalities and states and sometimes the federal government, too, are being so creative is actually an opportunity, because courts had gotten comfortable just ignoring and not caring that much about certain rights like economic liberty, and had also, I think, started to just pay less attention in general to the idea of due process. But when these new things come up, like, do you have to have an insanity defense? Can you punish people for the crimes of somebody else? Suddenly, courts actually have to focus on, what does due process mean? Are there things that are outside the power of the legislature? And that makes them have to actually consider due process, or what some would call substantive due process, in a way that they haven't in a long time, and really face the fact that although they would like to heap scorn upon substantive due process, some things actually go beyond it. And that, I think, is actually a good development for the law, because courts do need to recognize that there are things that governments are doing that you just can't do with law. And that shift, if it happens, and we're hoping it does, is going to be good for a lot of unenumerated rights as well. I mean, insanity defense is not enumerated, nor is economic liberty, nor for that matter is the right not to suffer some sort of penalty for the crimes of another person. Yet, once courts start to have to recognize those boundaries exist, I think it's going to help in other ways too.
So the opportunities are now coming up in new ways. And as you look at the decisions that are coming down in IJ cases and maybe in these other cases, other contexts, are you optimistic that courts are going to go in the right direction? Or do you think that the inclination is still towards deference?
It's a struggle because the inclination is certainly towards deference, right? That's what the Supreme Court has said for some time. But it's also true that when government goes too far, that can point out, that can cause a backlash, and that can also point out that there are boundaries, which is what Bob's been talking about. And it will be very good for courts to remind themselves that there are boundaries. And I think that will adhere to the benefit of us all.
Yeah, well, and it bodes well for IJ's future as well in terms of the kinds of cases we can bring and the impact we can make with them. So with that, we're out of time for today. Thank you to Bob and to Dana for joining us for the conversation, and thanks to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed the discussion today, please don't forget to let us know and to follow us and to subscribe.